our center for many, 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 many years, and he finally showed up. And I just want to tell you a little bit. I heard David many years ago. I think it was at an INTA conference in Portland, but it may not have been. He was singing with the band Alliance, the Trio Alliance. They were accompanying. It was really because of Lisa was speaking. And these three gorgeous men were singing these beautiful visionary songs, songs that I had never heard before. And their signature song was "I Love Myself the Way I Am." It wasn't written by them, but it certainly became theirs. And then the next time I saw him was at Asilomar. And there he is, singing solo and seeing these beautiful lyrics. Of course, I bought all of his CDs because they are so moving and visionary. Every single lyric sung so exquisitely leads one to an awareness of self, of growth. At one time, David and Reverend Dr. David and Reverend Dr. and Dr. Karen Drucker were co-leaders of the music part of the Asilomar Conference for several years. And one of those years when I had my talk there, I wanted to end with David's song, "I'm Here to Remind You." And he was so gracious to do that. And I couldn't help myself. I sang along and they didn't turn the sound off. So Josh is really well trained. The sound goes off when others are singing because some of those songs just grab you. So I promise, David, I won't speak while you're speaking. I won't sing if you're singing. But I will respect that your gift is so beautifully given. David's work in the world then moved him into ministry, first in Westlake Village, then he started to work in Mobile, Alabama, and now he is senior minister in a legacy center, the Center for Spiritual Living in Atlanta, which was Kennedy Schultz's center, and then became Paul Gagné's, and now it's David, it's really his. He is one of the sought-after speakers. I wonder, how can someone rise to this height of being sought after in such a short time? But when you think of how many hours he was on the platform for his singing, all of that prepared him for his speaking career. His work in the world, his ministry doesn't stop in Atlanta. His work in the world, and he will tell us more about it, I'm sure, goes to Cambodia and to his work there, helping bring fresh water to the people, especially the children in Cambodia. It's just my great, great joy. To honor him. Also, he's going to finish his year around the sun tomorrow. His birthday is tomorrow. And he is here to talk about you have options. Please welcome the Reverend Dr. David Ault.
Already disobeying the rules that say cannot bring anything but water in here, but I had bronchitis 4 weeks ago, and so that's my excuse for having tea up here, so don't tell anybody. Good morning.
Good morning.
It was Eleanor Roosevelt that said, you must do the thing you think you cannot do. You must do the thing you think you cannot do. And my favorite word in that whole sentence is must. You must. And I believe that as a student of mental science, a student of this particular philosophy, that should be our mantra. That should be our personal mission statement. We must do the thing that we think we cannot do. And why? Because what we teach about ourselves and what we forget is that we are infinite potentiality, constant. There is no break, there is no holiday from where you and I connected to this infinite source. And when we become complacent, when we become comfortable, I think that we forget that we are evolutionary beings, and that every single day, this 24-hour capsule that we are given, each and every day, each and every moment that we wake up, is the canvas by which you and I are supposed to prove these principles. We must do the thing that we think that we cannot do. And there are several phrases like that over the years that have made a tremendous impact on me. So Eleanor Roosevelt's quote certainly did. And also, years ago, I remember reading The Course in Miracles, and there was one line in there that stuck with me because I didn't understand it, and it took me off into this complete trajectory of trying to comprehend what it meant. And the line was this: love brings up everything unlike itself. Love brings up everything unlike itself. I used to go, what? What does that mean? And the more that I thought about it, the more that I realized that that particular sentence was a call to our authenticity. So, for example, if you and I are going to stand up and we're going to say, I am an advocate for love, and if we are here to prove these principles, then guess what happens? Everything unlike love shows up for us to do what? To prove and do the thing that we think we cannot do, which is to love in the moments where it appears as though love is absent. If you stand up and you say, I am an advocate for peace, then guess what? Everything unlike peace does what? It shows up for us in order, as students of this truth, to be able to authentically substantiate that statement, to give it muscle, to give it some oomph, to give it authenticity within us. Because it's not enough for you and I to just speak it. And the reason why you are here, the reason why you gravitated to this philosophy, I believe, is that there is a deeper calling within you, a hunger within you, for that which is this truth, for that which is this power, for that which tells us that whatever it is that we habitually focus on, we create. And so all of that power rests inside of us. And so what that tells me is, in my talk title today, is that you have options. You have options either to remember that and then abide by that and to devote your life to that, or you have options to neglect that. All the time, we're always talking about, who am I? Who am I? Why am I here? I came up with a better question. And the better question is, where am I? Where am I? And of course, if we answer that to the best of our ability, we come up with an answer something like, well, I'm standing in the midst of what we call the universe. Well, what is the universe? So I looked up in the back of the Science of Mind textbook to get what Ernest Holmes defined as the universe. And he called it the cosmic world. So you and I, where are we? We are in this cosmic world. And this is what I loved in the definition that Ernest said. He said, the universe in and of itself, then, is inherently perfect. When was the last time that you looked at all of your surroundings and you said, this is perfect? Everything that's going on in my world is perfect. However, that's a requirement for you and I as a student of truth, as a student of mental science. That's the work that we are called to do. And he said, not only is the universe perfect, but in order for us to label it as that, in order for us to call the universe perfect, then everything in it must be perfect.
And then it meets you.
Deductive reasoning 101. Isn't that fabulous? So, who are we to argue with that? And yet, you know what? The greatest obstacle that has been in my work with people, for it's been 30 years, can you believe me? And I'm only 39. I'll be double nickels tomorrow, 55. And so, if the universe is inherently perfect, and the only reason that it can be that is because everything within it is, then guess what your obligation is? Is to go upon an expedition. You're like a spiritual archaeologist. Your job, my job, every single day is to do what? Is to excavate more and more of that perfection. And people really struggle with that. Because here we are in this amazing kind of human skin suit. And I don't know about you, but there's a lot that I don't define as perfect in this human skin suit. 4 weeks ago, when I was hacking my lungs out with bronchitis, that didn't feel like perfection. But what is perfect? The part of us that is perfect is the soul, the essence, the truth of who we are. That is undeniable. And so we spend our entire lives integrating that which is the human part, the imperfection of us, to that which is perfect. And that's why we came here. Isn't that fun? Don't you love the fact that we're all going to die? That's my warm and fuzzy for you this morning. We're all going to die. And yet, not a lot of us that walk this planet in this skin suit are living. We don't know how to live. And to me, it's a beautiful thing in understanding that I have a finite time in order to prove the principle. I have a finite number of days on this planet whereby I get to look at my options and I get to say, today I choose to excavate more of my perfection rather than deny and neglect. And so tomorrow, when I turn 55, I will now have outlived my father, and I will have outlived all of my siblings except for one. And I come from a very large family. Because we had, on my father's side, we had a genetic heart malfunction. And don't you just love genetics where they say, I'm sorry, but this is what's going to happen to you. And then as a student of truth, knowing that there's a perfection behind the imperfection, you get to say what? Well, no, I'm not going to play that. And then, of course, that makes them more mad. And they want to throw all their Western ideals. But we had a genetic heart defect that ran down my father's side. And I have it as well. And well over 10 years ago, I had the surgery. I had the implant. I had the wires that go to the atrial and the ventricle. It's called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And what was so amazing about that particular journey was that it really heightened my sense of awareness and my practice as in being a religious scientist or a student of mental science. Because, let me tell you, there's nothing greater than being given this imperfection and then being willing to do what? Find the perfection in it. Love brings up everything unlike itself. Wholeness. I am an advocate for wholeness. Everything unlike wholeness shows up for us to do what? To prove the principle. And so now, after all of this time and all of this work, that's a whole other sermon in and of itself. But tomorrow, I will have outlived that. And one of the ways in which I celebrated my 54th year, which was the year that my father passed, was I decided that I had done all my spiritual work, I had done all this mental work. Well, not all, we're always working. But the last vestige of that was the physical. And I decided for the physical part, the way that I was going to sever any last tie to that limitation was just to go to Africa and climb Kilimanjaro. So I did that last August. Yeah. I don't recommend it. The hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But it was a fabulous, life-changing thing, much to the chagrin of my cardiologist. But the beautiful part about that is you're always realizing that you have options. And so you must do the thing that you cannot do is a blazing mantra that is going to incessantly whisper into your ear constantly. And you have an option. You have an option to disregard it, or you have an option to understand, you know what, I am an eternal being. Why not prove it? Here's my personal belief about being a minister. At some point, people will stop listening. At some point, people will stop listening if I, David, am not willing to go and prove the principle by means of it. And I think, what an amazing call. They don't teach you that in ministerial school. But that's true. I believe that there is a requirement for any of us who call ourselves these mental scientists in order to use these principles and not just play with them, but to be absorbed by them and to allow them to be the totality of who and what we are. And so, like I said, I started, Louise was my teacher, my mentor. I traveled Louise with her for many years back in the 80s. And as I look at the span of these 30 plus years, I just knew it intellectually for a number of those years. But it wasn't until the immersion happened, the hunger happened, the life situations happened, that I really migrated from the mental down into the heart in order for me to really, really get it. And what I love about all of us when we come together like this is we are a mixture of newbies, and we are a mixture of well-seasoned metaphysicians. But you know what? We're still all students. And there will never be a time when we will totally get it. And that's the beauty, because as an infinite being with infinite possibility, how can you ever tap that out? So my question to you is, where have you stopped? Where have you actually stopped or halted or stagnated in understanding what this principle is and how you as an individual get to use it? And there's no excuse. Age is not an excuse. Our economic background is not an excuse. Our geographical location is not an excuse. Because all of those things are irrelevant when you understand how we are tapped in, tuned in, and turned on to that which is source. And so here's the thing that begins to happen. When you make this sort of ceremonious vow to show up in the world and to play that way, then the world does what? It reciprocates back and it says, okay, let's play. Over 10 years ago, it's been 11 years now, back then I used to take people on what I called sacred site journeys. And we used to go all over the world. We would go to Machu Picchu, we would go to India, we would go to China, to the Great Wall. We would do all of these kinds of things. And one year, we went to Thailand and to And I had never been to Cambodia before, but if you know anything about it, that's where Angkor Wat is, which is the largest spiritual temple complex in the world. So I had a lot of people sign up for that particular tour. We went to Thailand first, and then we landed in Cambodia. And this has only happened a few times in my life. But when we landed in that country, I could actually feel this palpable physiological shift. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but back then, 11 years ago, it had only been 30 years since the genocide called the Khmer Rouge, which had wiped out more than 3 million Cambodians by a madman who had taken over that particular country. If you saw the movie The Killing Fields, that's all about the genocide in Cambodia. It had only been 30 years, and you would think, after something as cataclysmic as that, that there would be this rage, there would be this anxiety, there would be this anger, there would be this torment among its people. And guess what? It wasn't there. There was this extraordinary sense of peace and poise and equanimity. And it was really inexplicable to me. And it was doubly inexplicable to me when you merged it with the fact that the poverty level there is so extreme. And so when you get to Cambodia, you experience what's called the haves and the have-nots. The haves are the tourists, and the have-nots are all of the locals. And as the tourism has expanded, in order for these people to be able to visit this temple, all of the locals have been pushed back further and further and further into undesirable land. And the people who were on the tour with me, you know, sometimes those kinds of visuals are shocks to your system. And of course, they wanted to say, how can we support? What can we do? How can we help? So I went to our guide and I said, I have 15 captive people who would like to help. Where's the greatest need? And he thought for a moment and he said, well, you know, the largest waterway in all of Southeast Asia, it's called the Tonle Sap Lake, is right here in Siem Reap. And he said, in the dry season, which it was, the water recedes very, very far. And on this caked bed of mud and dirt, all of the transients come, all of the gypsies, all of the orphaned children, all of those people who have been affected by the landmines. All of those people come and they gravitate here and they sort of wait it out until the monsoons return. And he goes, there's so many children there, so many displaced children that are starving, that if you could bring them food somehow, that would be the greatest gift that I could think of. And I'm thinking, how do we do that? And this was long before cell phones were widespread. It's funny today, you go to Cambodia, and even the Buddhist monks have a cell phone. Right? But this was long before this. And he said, but you can't just show up there with food because it will be utter chaos. He goes, I've got to get a message to the matriarch of this village. So even a transient gypsy village has a matriarch. And I still don't know how he did it. Carrier pigeon. I don't know how he did it. But he sent a message ahead. And as he sent this message, we went to three local markets and we bought every single thing that they had. And guess what the total was? After wiping out three local markets of family run vendors, $86. And it was in that moment I remember standing there in the dirt in Cambodia going, are you kidding me? I could do something, you know, on a sustainable basis, and that's all that it takes. And I remember we loaded all of this food and provisions into these vans, and off we went down to the tunnel shop. And when we got there, the matriarch had hundreds of children lined up. And I think we've got a slide or two that I'm going to show you as they bring those up. But you could advance to the next one. But this is what we came to. And there are hundreds of them lined up. And we started to distribute the food. I think in the next one, yeah. And just absolute filth everywhere that you saw. And so as we began to distribute this, it was orderly at first. But that only lasted about 15 minutes. And then off in the distance, there was this thunderous roar of other children who had heard that there were food. And they came and they began to grab. And before you know it, all of the provisions were gone. And we stood there, and we were sort of covered with all these little muddy handprints. And when it was over, something began to happen inside of me. Our founder, Ernest Holmes, sometimes he calls these kinds of things mystical experiences, where you and I have a revelation or an awareness of oneness. But when all of this was done, this overwhelming sense of emotion was wanting to come out of me. And you know that place where there's no place to run and no place to hide? You go, uh-oh, this is going to be messy. And so I crawled onto one of those pontoon boats. It was an empty pontoon boat. And I began to quail. And what was so unusual about this was that I was not crying out of pity. I was crying because this physiological burst in my heart had happened, and I realized that I was the child and the child was me. And so it was crouched in one of those pontoon boats on the Tonle Sap that I made a vow. And I said, I will come back and I will figure out something. I don't know how. Don't you love it when you don't know how? But you say, I will come back. And so every year after that, I began to come back, thinking that I would find some type of alliance to be able to work with in order to create some sustainable programs. And this went on for quite a while, and I was not able to find anybody for a couple of years. Until finally, I did meet someone, and we started to dig water wells in the village, because most of the Cambodians in the village, they would just drink out of a mud hole. And out of the mud hole, of course, is a lot of disease. And the disease creates a very limited lifespan for the children. And so providing them fresh water is a huge, huge undertaking. And it was one of those years where, as we were digging this well, I said, gosh, if we can dig a well for $300, what would it cost to build a school? Kind of very Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, let's, you know, build it. And the reason why I asked that is I saw that a very limited number of children were actually going to school. And I discovered at that time that you had to pay. You had to pay to go to a government school. And the things that they taught in the government schools were very limited. And so what I wanted to do was figure out a way to provide education. And he said, and the guy said to me, you would do that? I said, yeah, why not? How hard could it be? And so he told me of the, I had to go to the People's Party of Cambodia, the government office, and I needed to go through the process of applying for an application. And I remember walking in my naivete and telling them that I wanted to build a school, and I got interrogated, and I got strip searched, and I got put in a holding cell. I was very excited. I will tell you, it was one of the scariest days of my life. And all of this mental posturing that went on, and as I was in there, they kept saying, why do you want to do this? You know, who are you working for? It's ridiculous. And I'm going to go, oh, but all I wanted to do was just provide free education. And so they took all of my money. I did fill out some paperwork. I did remember that. But nothing came of it. And then I was released. And I kept going back. Isn't that fabulous? Stupid. I kept going back, even though I could find no support, because I had made a vow. Part of making a vow is that when you know that you know that you know. You know, our founder Ernest Holmes said it's not enough to hope. He said it's not even enough to believe. That you must not stop until you know. And so when you know that you know, that you are called, that you are there to prove the principle, then you just keep showing up, even when it doesn't make any sense. And so several years passed, and then I think it's the next slide. In 2009, see the gentleman over here? His name was Owen. And so I was working with Owen, and he picked me up from the airport, and I got on the back of a scooter, and he took me to a bar. And we're sitting in the bar, and it was kind of like Casablanca with a little rusted fan blowing. And he pulled out this paper, and he said, I got your school. After I'd forgotten about it and let it go, and that was in January 2009. And so to surprise me, he had put up some sticks, and they put up that thatched roof, and there were over 200 kids waiting for me there, and I went, because you know when you can't turn back, you go, uh-oh, and I went, wow, you're really invested now. And so needless to say, we didn't stay here because this was way out in undesirable territory. It was off the grid. We needed electricity. So throughout the years, a year after this, we moved in. I think the next slide. We moved in, and we began to build outdoor pavilions where we started to open our doors and provide free education. We have over 200 students that show up every single day, even in the monsoons. Can you imagine showing up at the gates, even in the monsoons? The next slide. And so I take people with me every year, and they get involved and they teach. Next slide. We have all different kinds of programs. You have to love kids because these kids are amazing. Next. So we start every morning with song and music and drills. And they just keep showing up. And we've maxed it out. And over the years, we've developed systems now, because we used to not be able to trace what village they were from, because sometimes they would show up for several months and then they would disappear. And so we started to do files on each of them and encourage them. Next slide. We go into the villages and teach them hygiene. Next slide. You can see why. Next slide. And next slide. And so we began to build projects every year. And so on our little parcel of land at our school, next slide, we built a sewing center and a music center. And we built, next slide, we built a, this is the, anyone who wants to learn these life skills trainings, next my long-term vision is that if they keep coming back, we want to be able to provide education for them at a university level standard practice. And so I look at this, and this is very much comparative to my life as a religious scientist, as a student of mental science, because when you can see the obstacle, but you can allow yourself to burst through the obstacle, do you get that you all have a Kilimanjaro to climb? Do you get that you all have a Cambodian experience to walk through? That every single one of us is called to prove the principle. Every single one of us is called to remember that we have an option. And the option is to embrace that level of perfection or to deny it. So I wrote this little thing about options on here, and it said, you have options about every single facet of your earthly life. Take that in for a minute. You have an option about every single thing. Think about our attitudes. You have an option about our attitude. You have options about every single facet of your earthly life. Options on how to react, how to perceive, how to feel, where to go, whom to go with. Most importantly, you have options on how to think. And what makes our lives so painful at times is that we pretend that we don't. That we don't have options. That we are helpless or powerless to forces outside of us. This may have been your reality before you and I reawakened from our deep sleep, but it is not our reality. Are we in agreement with that? It is not your reality. This pretending that we are bound, we believe, will actually help us with our pain. But what it does is it actually prolongs it, intensifies it, and makes life unbearable to live. You have options. I have options. And therefore, we have no excuse not to thrive and experience genuine happiness in this world other than the reality that we have chosen the option. The option to withhold our joy because of retaliation, prejudice, resentment, grievance, or self-loathing. And there was this quote that I ran across from Abraham Hicks' material that said, you can never have a happy ending at the end of an unhappy journey. Kind of ludicrous to think that it can happen, right? But that the journey is what? The journey is now. You can never have a happy ending at the end of an unhappy journey. It just doesn't work out that way. The way you're feeling along the way is the way you're continuing to prepay your journey. And it's the way it's going to continue to turn out until you do something about how you feel. So I have a deep admiration for you because I have a deep admiration and a life devoted to this teaching because I know the requirements that it asks of us. Don't you love